It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. Coming up, the Kitchen Sisters take us around the world to explore the stories behind the food we eat. First, it's the end of the year. Legislators have packed up and left Washington, and the numbers are in. According to GovTrack.us, the 113th United States Congress was the least productive since 1973. They also set a new record for unpopularity, hitting a 9% approval rating in November 2013. Throughout the year, we spoke with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer to keep track of what Congress was and wasn't doing. Lawmakers did pass a Veterans Affairs reform bill and, at the last minute, a spending bill to keep the government open. They also took steps towards an NSA reform bill, which died in the Senate. But they punted on big issues like immigration and tax reform. With us now for a look back at the year in Congress is USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. Paul, it's good to have you.
Thanks very much, Veronica. Good to be with you.
Well, GovTrack.us compiled data on the number of bills passed from all Congresses since 1973, and they determined that this Congress, the 113th, has been the least productive governing body in all of those years. Do you see this as a blip, or is there some sort of deeper systemic problem that's getting in the way of legislators passing laws?
Well, it's certainly not a blip. In fact, and I mean this with no disrespect to GovTrack, we've been writing that story now for the past 5 or 6 years, every year. It's become a sort of a chestnut story for us every year that, this Congress was even less productive than the last Congress. It's true. I mean, I don't mean to dismiss that. It is true. And the reason it's true is the reason that is sort of everybody, I think, recognizes is becoming wrong with American politics, is that the partisan divides make compromise almost impossible, and the political rewards for compromise are much, much less than the political rewards for intransigence on both sides. You have a much better opportunity to go out to the voters and say, we didn't get this done because my opponent is an idiot, than you do standing next to your opponent saying, we worked together and achieved this great thing. Doesn't help you very much. It's every year it gets less and less and less.
Are you saying the voters themselves might be a little bit responsible for this 9% approval rating in Congress?
Yes. I mean, flat out, yes. I mean, part of the reason why there is a poor approval rating of Congress is because, voters send people to Congress, and the most active voters are the most partisan in both sides. And the least active voters are the more moderate. So the number of people who are voting drops. The passion and intensity of the people who are voting rises. And so the passion and intensity of the lawmakers rises, and they don't see any upside to trying to achieve things for the voters who aren't going to show up anyway.
Well, they may not have a high approval rating, the 113th Congress, but we're going to look back at what did happen in Congress this year, and we'll start with what they did pass. The VA reform bill, this had bipartisan support. Why this bill? Why did this have such success?
Well, that is a good example of the news driving the legislative agenda. I mean, early in this year, there were several news stories. Actually, it was Congressman Jeff Miller, the chairman of the VA committee, who kicked this whole thing off. But there were reports and news stories about veterans getting poor care at veterans facilities. And before long, the studies and the reports were beginning to pile up that, in fact, there was a secret bookkeeping system at the VA where there is a legal limit for how long a veteran is supposed to wait for care. The people in the VA system were manipulating their books to make it look like people had not been waiting too long, when in fact they had been waiting much, much longer than they were legally allowed to be waiting, and some in fact died on the waiting list. That galvanized Congress. And so Congress did basically what you would expect them to do. They passed a law that said, essentially, we can't have this. This is a bad thing, and people at VA should be able to be fired. Now, I will tell you that the reporting since then has been that it's not entirely clear that a lot of people at VA have been fired, because it's more complicated than just passing a law saying you should fire people, because there's a bunch of other laws that already exist to protect people in the civil service. So Congress did pass a law. They are focused on that topic. They really wanted to address the crisis at hand. But starting next year, it's last year's news, and I'm not entirely sure how much attention it's going to get.
Well, another thing that passed recently as well, the $1.1 trillion spending bill, the omnibus spending bill, cronibus, both those things that went through recently. How is the way that Congress went about passing that legislation different from the way they've historically considered spending bills?
Well, let me go back to your first question for a second about why Congress doesn't get anything done and why we see a dropping number of bills passed. The omnibus is a literally rolls up all 12 federal spending bills that used to pass as individual bills. So when you're doing historic comparisons, it used to be that there was a labor and health and human services bill that funded the Labor Department. There was a veterans and EPA bill that funded those agencies. Those bills don't exist anymore. Now they all get rolled into one big bill at the end of the year. So right there, that's 12 fewer bills Congress gets to pass in a year. The second problem is that because it's the big funding bill for everything in government, it ends up getting 30 or 40 or 150 other things attached to it that, again, things you might otherwise in normal historic time have passed as standalone legislation.
Something now, like the Dodd-Frank, for instance, or?
Yeah, like, you know, changing the marijuana laws in a state or you know, delisting the speckled grouse or whatever it was they did on this cromnibus bill. Those things only count as one bill. But there's 100 of them in there.
So a lot of things crammed into one bill. Some of them, you know, as you said on the show earlier, we're still sort of unpacking everything that's in that thing.
That's right. And again, we call it a Christmas tree for a reason. You know, it comes at the end of the year and it's full of ornaments. And everybody wants to get their ornament hung on to it. And this is, you know, the traditional year-end thing in Congress these days is, you know, there's a couple of must-pass bills. Nothing else is going to get voted on. Nothing else is going to get passed. So you try to get your issue du jour attached to that bill. That's what they did this time.
Well, I've got a list here of some of the things Congress didn't do, things they did not pass. And at the top of that list, immigration reform, although we had some action on that, obviously, in a different manner. But also on that list, NSA reform, a minimum wage hike. They didn't repeal Obamacare. What am I missing?
Well, there's a bunch of stuff they didn't do. You know, just in the past couple of weeks, interestingly, I was very surprised they did not pass an extension of terrorism insurance for large commercial buildings. This was a federal program that was created after 9/11 that basically says the federal government will have a kind of a bailout fund because, you know, 9/11 or a similarly sized terrorist event could cost hundreds of billions of dollars. There are no insurers in the private market that can afford to pay that off. So the government says, well, you know, over $500 million, whatever the number was, we'll pay. That program expires at the end of 2014, and the whole thought was, oh, they'll just extend it. But they didn't because, again, there were a couple of conservatives who believed it's a federal government bailout of what should be a private industry, and they didn't want to pass it. So all kinds of things, from the big to the small like that.
So, Paul, of those things we just talked about, are there any on the list that you see as possibly coming for a second go-round in 2015?
Yeah, well, you know, the first one will be the Keystone XL pipeline, which came to a vote just at the end of November, in part because Senator Mary Landrieu from Louisiana was trying to rescue her seat in the Senate. She had a December 6th runoff for her seat, which she lost. And the Keystone XL bill died, so that pipeline remains in limbo. I'm almost certain it'll be the first, if not the second thing the Senate turns to when they get back in January and the Republicans are in charge. They have said very clearly they want that bill to pass. I would not be surprised to see NSA reform come back. I would not be surprised to see terrorism insurance come back. I don't think you're going to get an immigration bill. Although what you may get is a series of smaller bills trying to block the president's executive action. It's hard to figure out how they're going to do that, but they did reserve for themselves the funding for Homeland Security Department. That expires in February, so it'll give them another opportunity to argue about whether there's a way they can block Obama's executive orders in that bill.
Now, going back to NSA reform, that seemed like at the time it was going to blow up. It was going to be a huge, well, it was a huge story, and it seemed likely that there would be some legislative action on it. In the end, it just sort of fizzled out. What happened?
Well, again, you run into these issues where legislation is more complicated than people give the credit for. I mean, it's one thing to say, gosh, we should stop the NSA from spying, but it's a lot harder to sort of figure out how you write a law that does that, and how you write a law that does that, that still gets bipartisan support from Republicans and Democrats and from the industry and from the privacy rights advocates. I mean, one of the arguments here is that, well, we shouldn't have the government collecting all this information. And so the NSA says, oh, okay, we'll collect it, but we'll require the private companies to store it instead of us storing it. Well, you want a bunch of private companies having all this secret information? Is that better than having the government have it? You know, it's hard to legislate this stuff. And they thought they had an opportunity to do it at the end of this year. Senator Leahy of Vermont was the chairman of the Judiciary Committee. He's very interested in this topic. It fell apart. Next year, he will no longer be the chairman because he's a Democrat. There will be a Republican chairing that committee. We'll see whether it becomes a hot topic again. But keep in mind that this one is bipartisan. You know, I mean, a lot of Republicans are unhappy about NSA spying as well. So this is a bill that has a chance, I think.
We're talking with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. He joins us every week to cover what Congress is and isn't getting done. Today we look back at what happened this year on Capitol Hill. This is Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. We're back with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer. He joins us every week to talk about what is and isn't getting done in Congress. Right now we're continuing our conversation about the year in Washington. In terms of bills that seem pretty unlikely to pass because of lack of bipartisan support from the get-go, this year we had the minimum wage hike, which didn't make it, and a repealing of Obamacare for Republicans. How much time did Congress spend on maybe politically unrealistic legislation like that?
Well, it's going to be interesting next year because 2014 you had divided government in the Congress. That is, Republicans controlled the House, Democrats controlled the Senate, and their agendas were very, very different. And so Republicans in the House spent an awful lot of time voting on bills that they knew the Republican Senate would never pass. To some degree, you could argue the Democratic Senate did the same by passing stuff like an immigration bill that the House was not going to pass, although I think they actually had some hope that the House might pass that bill. But nevertheless, what will be interesting next year is, would the House vote on the same bills, whether it's, you know, repeal of Obamacare or, I don't know, pick a topic, gun control, abortion, whatever it is, would the House vote on those same bills if they think there's a Republican Senate that might actually pass them as well? Right? I mean, sometimes it's easy when you control only one chamber of the House, because you can pass anything, because you know it's not going anywhere. There's no risk of it actually becoming law. It's just good politics. Next year, the Republicans won't have that kind of a backstop, so they're going to have to be a little more cautious about what they put on top of the agenda.
And moving on to the immigration bill, you mentioned, you said you thought that one might have had a shot of passing the House. In the end, it didn't get there. What do you think happened with that one, considering it seemed as though there was such a political push to reform immigration? In the end, President Obama took executive action, but how did that one sort of meet its fate?
Well, you know, the Senate crafted a bill, and there was a big sort of compromise chunk of the bill that basically said, in order to comfort the Republicans, who are very concerned particularly about border security, we're going to stick billions of dollars in here to beef up security along the U.S.-Mexican border. And the idea was that that would be enough to bring along enough Republicans to and give them some political cover so they could vote for the bill. And starting in January, there was some talk that they might actually be able to take this up, and they started, you know, gathering Republicans to talk about the policy and what they might do with the bill. But it became clear pretty early on in the year they didn't have a whole lot of interest. And I think it was you know, I'm not very smart, and I don't really remember many things, but I think it was like February or so, that Speaker Boehner was circulating a set of principles for legislation. That was a pretty good tip-off that they weren't serious about passing a bill. Because if you're starting from draft principles, when you've already got a bill sitting over here you could be working off of, it implies that you're sort of backing up to square one. And then over time, of course, the crisis at the border of young children showing up, unaccompanied minors showing up at the border, thousands of them suddenly coming to the border, that became the stopping point. Because at that point, Republicans were convinced that it was happening because Obama's policies were making it look like if you got here illegally, you could stay. So they didn't want to engage in a question about legislation. All they wanted to engage in was a question about shutting down that border, dealing with these children. Now, I will say, you know, Congress did approve money to, allow the president to address the border crisis, that particular border crisis. But at that point, it was clear that a larger bill was dead. And that's why Obama ultimately took executive action, because he said he doesn't think he can get a bill through Congress.
Now, looking at the midterm elections, come January, Republicans, Congress will be there. Republicans will have the largest majority since Truman. In terms of what happened at the midterms, is this basically a story about how voters just aren't into President Obama right now? In fact, kind of the opposite. He's very unpopular.
Yeah, that's a lot of it. Obama is unpopular, and they're beheading Americans and others in Syria, and, you know, there's Ebola across the world. And I mean, just the news has been just a drumbeat of bad news. The funny thing is, it was a drumbeat of bad news leading up to the election. Since then, things have actually looked a little better for Obama. But it was bad news for Obama. And keep in mind, it wasn't just that people were voting against the Democrats. It was also that the huge Democratic turnout machine that came to the polls to vote for Barack Obama was not coming to the polls to vote for people like Mark Pryor in Arkansas and Mary Landrieu in Louisiana. It wasn't there. You couldn't get, and Democrats typically turn out in lower numbers in midterm elections, and I think this year was a prime example of that.
Now, the takeaway for the Republican Party throughout the election cycle seemed to be that the Tea Party had sort of lost its sway. There was, though, a minor earthquake with House Majority Leader Eric Cantor losing out. What did his loss mean for the party?
Can I be completely frank with you?
Of course.
I don't think the Eric Cantor loss means a great deal for the Republican Party other than this. Eric Cantor was not well-liked. He wasn't well-liked in Congress. He wasn't well-liked in his district. I mean, if there's a message at all, it's tend to your knitting. If they don't like you at home, it doesn't matter what you're doing at the national level.
Talking about the Republican majorities that will be in Congress come January, will those majorities work with President Obama so they don't just keep putting legislation on his desk that he's going to veto?
I don't really know. I mean, it has been very clear that Speaker John Boehner and incoming Majority Leader Mitch McConnell have said they plan to work with Obama. They've said they don't want to be the party that just says no. They don't want to just fight. They want to prove they can govern. I mean, I think for 2016, there's a presidential election coming up, and they need to prove that they can govern and can do things that people care about and achieve things. It's a tricky situation, right, because the only way they can do that is by standing next to President Obama and shaking hands on a piece of paper, which may not be the best image for them, particularly in a Republican primary season. There's some belief in 2010 that part of what killed the governor of Florida at the time, Charlie Crist, was his picture with hugging Barack Obama. So that's going to be a challenge. You have to govern. You have to prove you can govern, and yet you can't stand too close to a president who is wildly unpopular in your party. But yeah, I think there's stuff they're going to try and do. I mean, I think I believe they're going to try and make some deal on trade. Maybe they'll try and make some deal on this Terrorism Insurance Act. Maybe they'll try and make some deal on NSA. You know, places where they think they can get a bipartisan agreement to do something and not just look like they're here to wage the next war.
And Paul, briefly as we wrap up, you know, lest we think nobody's having fun in Congress, there was kind of a dance-off in 2014 that happened.
Yeah, one of my favorites, Congressman John Lewis, who's a civil rights hero and a 74-year-old congressman from Georgia, posted a tweet and on his Facebook page a video of him dancing to Pharrell Williams' Happy Song, and he was sort of singing along and swinging his hips, and it went viral. And the next day, Charlie Rangel, who's 80-something, congressman from New York, posted a tweet basically saying, "You're my hero, John Lewis, but you don't have moves, I got moves." And then he had a video of himself dancing, and then there was a bunch of other people pulled up video of politicians dancing, and, you know, it became a viral Twitter sensation for, oh, I don't know, probably 2 or 3 hours, and then we moved on. But it was fun, and it's a reminder that ultimately, you know, these people are just people, too, and when they can shake off politics for a few minutes, they can let loose a bit.
Paul, thanks a lot. It was great tracking political analysis Congress with you in 2014, and we look forward to talking more in 2015.
I look forward to it, Veronica. Thanks for making me part of your show.
We've been speaking with USA Today politics editor Paul Singer about the year in Congress. The 113th United States Congress finished out the session as the least productive since 1973. Coming up, it's Food Friday, and we catch up with the Kitchen Sisters, who take us around the world and back in time in their Hidden Kitchen series. I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferrant is out today. Food is at the heart of countless cultural traditions and stories around the world, but some of these stories have largely been a secret until the Kitchen Sisters came along. Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva bring the culture and history of food alive through their podcast and radio series, Hidden Kitchens. Wisconsin Public Radio has been airing the series on the Ideas Network, and the final installment airs on Monday night at 6. This week, the show takes us traveling for culinary stories from around the globe. For Food Friday, the Kitchen Sisters join us from the studios of KQED in San Francisco to offer a peek inside Hidden Kitchens. Davia, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
And Nikki, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
Well, first of all, Davia, for those who might not be familiar with your work, what is the Hidden Kitchens Project?
Hidden Kitchens is a series of stories about secret, unexpected, below-the-radar cooking, how communities come together through food. And we asked people around the country. It's a big nationwide collaboration. We opened up phone lines on NPR. We reach out to people in through social media, and we say, who glues your community together? What are the rituals and rites of the kitchen that bind your community? And we've been on the hunt for them now for several years.
And people know you on the air as the Kitchen Sisters. How did that name come to be? Did it come out of love of food, friendship, all of the above?
We started at a radio station in Santa Cruz, California, in a little non-commercial station, and we did a live radio show there for years. And we were getting ready to interview this guy who had written a book about local architecture, and it was about the same time that I had just moved into this commune in Santa Cruz, and Davia and I were preparing for our weekly show and trying to cook a dinner of salmon at the same time for this group of people. And we got so distracted by our studies here in preparing for this architectural interview that that we burned the meal. And one of the big distracting factors was that we read about these two brothers, the Kitchen Brothers, who built by the light of the moon. And there was all this legend and lore about them. In fact, hardly any facts, mostly just stories from the neighborhood. And we were just enthralled. They built with abalone shells and brick, and they sent messages to the submarines that were supposedly lurking out in the Monterey Bay during World War II through these towers of abalone. So the next day when we got on air and the interview was kind of lagging, we said to the guy who wrote the book, well, tell us about the Kitchen Brothers, you know, not to be confused with the Kitchen Sisters, which everybody had started calling us the night before. So the name stuck, and somebody, one of our friends, made a bumper sticker that said, Free the Kitchen Sisters, and it just sort of took off. And it's been great because it's a name that kind of fits, although when we began, and a lot of our stories are not about food, but the kitchen is really the place where people come together to talk and tell stories, and it's the most comfortable room in the house, so it seems appropriate for the work that we do.
Well, when we look at your Hidden Kitchens project, it sounds as though ideas must have come pouring into you from all over. How did you decide what to chase?
I know, that's always the hardest part. I mean, some of them were like emergency calls, you know, like 911, come to this peach orchard. They are about to cut down the last of the peach trees, and we must chronicle the life of this peach before it goes. Or the last old Czech immigrant is about to die, and with him dies the strudel recipe. Or, you know, our neighborhood library is threatened, and we're going to have a clam boil. To keep it open, you must be here for the clam boil. I mean, people, there was such urgency with these stories. You know, some of them are just so delightful, and some of them are people, like we say, who glue their community together through food, who have, you know, some people run for elected office and some people sort of elect themselves to create their community, to lead their community, to raise their money. And so many of the people that we heard about were those people using the kitchen as the way to do that.
And some of the stories were just stories we had never even imagined, you know, like the story of the George Foreman grill and using an appliance as a hidden kitchen for the homeless and for new immigrants, and, you know, someone calling in about that idea and just sort of triggering a thought that we had never even kind of imagined when we began dreaming up the series.
Did you ever get surprised along the way about how much the story of food, looking at the world through the lens of food, really did have just this direct pipeline into the human story?
Yeah, food is the universal language. It's one of the only things we all have in common. And people, it is so incredible to us as we've been gathering all these kitchen stories for years now, how much it is food that can bring people together, food and music, you know, traditional politics and religion and all that seem to be so faltering right now. But that breaking of bread, and so often people who are enemies because they live so close to one another, what they do have in common is what they eat. One of the stories that we're working on for this coming year is a story we call Operation Hummus. And it's looking at hummus in the Middle East as this flashpoint, but also this potential for Arabs and Israelis to come together through food. And we're kind of looking into that whole, that this next themes of Hidden Kitchens world will be looking at food as a way to peace and food as part of diplomacy for just that reason.
Well, I want to get to your newest episode, Hidden Kitchens World, which is going to air Monday night at 6 on this station. And we travel the globe in just the matter of an hour, starting with a look at mafia-free olive oil and pasta and wine in Italy and Sicily. And before we get into that story, let's hear a little bit about the background. How did you get turned on to that story?
Every 2 years, we go to Italy to Slow Food. The Slow Food movement has a big gathering called Terra Madre. And there, people from 136 countries come. They bring their wine, they bring their food, they bring their prosciutto, their cheeses, their reindeer, their cacao, their rice. Anyway, there was a man who was there from Sicily, who was part of an agricultural cooperative called Libera Terra. And it's been years now that the Sicilian government has been confiscating mafia lands, and these are some of the best lands in Sicily. And finally now, people in Sicily have organized themselves into agricultural cooperatives to farm this land. And this man said to us, you know, we are doing organic farming because we have to purify our land, to purify ourselves. And there was a woman, Marie Dozema, who'd been interning with us. And she met this man and she led him to us. And all of us went together to Sicily to go chronicle their work and see for ourselves. And so everyone around the world could hear for themselves about their work. We call the story the Pizza Connection.
Well, it's fascinating that so much of Italian food has connections to the mafia, that there is this small revolution going to reclaim that. What do you think about the consciousness raising that's going on in terms of the mafia ties to food and what it means to people in Italy now?
I think it's huge. And I think that was one of the things that really pulled us to this story was the fact that, you know, people say, you know, vote with your fork, vote with your what you buy here in this country. But there in Italy, it really means if you choose to buy food that has no connection to the mafia, you are really making a political statement. Still, so many, 80% of businesses do pay money to the mafia, just sort of as protection money. That's still happening. And if you refuse to do that, you're endangering your business and maybe your lives. And these people who go into the stores and say, no, I want to buy something that I know has no connection to the mafia, either it has a particular stamp which says that there's no connection, or it's been grown by one of these cooperatives. I think it's so meaningful. It's a real statement, a political statement. Someone in the piece says it's a slap in the face to the mafia.
Well, let's listen to a little bit of the Pizza Connection from Hidden Kitchen's World. Here it is.
The last year, mafia burned olive trees. They went there and they burned each one. It's a sign. It means that the mafia are still there, and if they can burn a tree, maybe they can also kill you if they want. We don't want to go out of the field with police. It's a wrong message. We have to show to the people that to work with Libera, it's a good thing.
How did you find these people and get them to talk, considering that the threat of mafia is still very real in Italy?
I know they are such kitchen heroes, which is what the series is a lot about. Who are the kitchen pioneers and visionaries, the local kitchen heroes? And that's what we search for. And these are cooperatives right on the edges of Palermo. And we just followed one voice to another. You know, whenever we're gathering our stories, along with interviewing whoever we interview, we say, who else should we talk to for this story? And when you say that in Sicily, it led us to the Anti-Mafia Museum up in the town of Corleone. And it led us to the farmers who are farming the lands of the cooperative. It led us to Turin, to the priest, Don Luigi Ciotti, who started the whole idea of Libera Terra. You know, one thread follows another.
We're talking with Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva, also known as the Kitchen Sisters. They're co-producers of the radio series Hidden Kitchen. You can hear the final installment of that series on Monday night at 6 right here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. It's Food Friday, and this week we're talking with the Kitchen Sisters, Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva. They're the co-producers of the Hidden Kitchen series. You can hear the next episode Monday at 6 on this station. We're going to turn now to a piece of history that kind of blew my mind. There were dogs that used to be used in the kitchens turning the spits. Tell us about these dogs.
I know. Who knew that turnspit dogs were the way in old Georgian kitchens in England? There had once been small children, little orphan boys who, you know, people know about child labor, who had to turn, I guess, the big spits of meat, whole joints of meat, huge from animals were the way that people would eat. And there'd be these 4, 5, 6 hours of turning to roast the meat. Someone along the way got the idea to put dogs in wooden wheels with a pulley system, and that would replace the small boys.
Here's how one historian you talked with describes the way spit-turned dogs were used.
There is a chain from the spit up to a wheel, and in that wheel is a small dog running frenetically, causing the spit to turn. The roar of the fire, the clanking of the spit, the patter from the little dog's feet. One way of training the dog was to throw a glowing coal into the wheel to make the dog speed up a bit.
Nikki, that sounds like kind of a terrible life for a dog. It doesn't sound something like PETA would be on board with today. When did people start moving away from that?
That happened fairly, in my mind, late. But around 1900 or so, they sort of stopped doing these kinds of things to these poor little dogs because not out of, pity, although I think there was some of that because the at that time the SPCA was coming into being and people were concerned about the treatment of animals, but more because there was a replacement for the dogs, and that was a mechanism called the clock jack. So really, it became kind of unfashionable to have dogs running in wheels in your kitchen, and they began using these machines that took over.
What happened to that breed?
It's extinct, although I swear since we did this piece, I feel like I see turnspit dogs everywhere. If you look at pictures of them, you'll recognize them. I'm sure there are descendants running around.
Yeah, didn't you say somewhere in the piece that it's possible that these spit-turned dogs became, the corgi, which is the queen's dog? It could have gone quite a way in its journey.
Yeah, I don't know if the queen would be happy about that, but I think it is related. It's related to a lot of different dogs. It has very short legs, I guess all the better to run with, and they're kind of, their feet are sort of pointed in. They have kind of crooked front legs, short tails, long ears, and they're very long-bodied. And there's only one certified turnspit dog left, and that's in a museum in Wales. It's stuffed.
Is there
a picture of that on the website, too, if you'd like to look.
Great. Well, are there any other examples of this, of animals that were essentially used like kitchen utensils that you found?
We've started to see pictures of donkeys and mules and burros that were doing butter churns, where they would be outside and be on a sort of a wooden lead. And through doing that, it would be like turning a mill, and butter was being churned that way. In fact, the Benjamin Franklin's Gazette was selling the wheels for turnspit dogs. And Benjamin Franklin's wife was thinking, or the wife, I'm sorry, of William Penn from Pennsylvania, was thinking about could she have a turnspit dog to churn her butter? So I think it's mules and, but probably people have used dogs for all. I mean, you just think about even the dog being put with a little keg under its chin, the St. Bernard's, and carrying warm liquids into the mountains. Yeah. We bring animals into the kitchen one way or another.
Well, one of your stories in Hidden Kitchens World, it highlights how the kitchen is this hub of the community, as you say, sort of the glue that holds people together. And that seems especially true in post-revolution Russia. Can you tell us, Davia, about some of these dissident kitchens?
Sure. We were in Moscow and we were having lunch with this very noted television producer. We just said to him, "So what's your hidden kitchen?" And he said, "Dissident kitchens. The Soviet Union fell apart because of the kitchen." And we sort of said, "Well, I think we'll have to be following up on that story." And it turned out it led us to a two-part story, one about communal kitchens and one about dissident kitchens. And when the revolution happened in Russia and became the Soviet Union, a lot of the culture was communalized, people moving into apartments that once had had one wealthy family, and now it was 10 families with one restroom and one kitchen, and all these people vying for space, vying for time, vying for stove time. Anyway, for decades, people lived like that in these cramped conditions, and also feeling like neighbors were spying on one another. And the sort of the beginnings of the KGB comes along, Khrushchev, after the deaths of Lenin and Stalin. And one of the reforms, we're now into the 1950s, one of the reforms Khrushchev built these apartment buildings. And in these apartment buildings, people could have their own places, and they had private kitchens for the first time in decades. And in these kitchens, ideas could flourish, conversation could flourish, music that was forbidden could come and be heard and be surreptitiously recorded. The samizdats, the books, you know, even Dr. Zhivago, things like that, that could be circulated and typed up in these kitchens on illicit typewriters. They just became the sort of secret galleries and bookstores and concert halls of the culture became the kitchen.
So from these dissident kitchens, where it very much served a function that was communal, but it also was a holding place for culture, to today, we still treat the kitchen like this. It's still a gathering point. It's still where a lot of the action happens. What is it, do you think, Nikki, about the kitchen that makes it such a potent place even today?
You know, it's the hearth. It's so primitive. It's that being drawn to the fire, being drawn to the food. It's the warmest place. I mean, in many cultures, people sleep on top of the ovens and, you know, these big kitchens are close to the fire. It's primal. And we see it. What I love about the two Soviet Union stories is how in one story, it's described as this hell because of this of not being trusted. And I think that's such a breach of trust not to trust your kitchen or to be comfortable in your kitchen, and then to see it evolve into, with the dissident kitchens and the privacy and the ability to come in and bring your friends, which is the tradition of the kitchen, it becomes this real haven for culture and for freedom, really.
One thing that we were amazed by, how many fairy tales from Russia center in the stove. Almost, you know, the stove as Aladdin's lamp, the stove as the magic carpet, the stove of the one strange boy in the family who never leaves the stove and sleeps. The old stoves in these old kind of cabins that people lived in Russia, usually the grandparents would sleep in the stove. There was a shelf because it was the warm room. But so the fairy tales, so many Russian fairy tales, have this character that stays on the stove for their entire life. But then the Cossacks come and attack, and suddenly this weak, homebound stove hog rises with all the power from staying there and being so warm, and he vanquishes the Cossacks because he has the mighty power of the stove under him. So talk about the potent place.
Yeah, that's so cool. I'm going to think about my stove entirely differently now.
The potential to vanquish your enemy.
Exactly, it sounds like. Well, thank you both. This was great.
Thanks so much.
Thanks.
That was Davia Nelson and Nikki Silva, also known as the Kitchen Sisters. You can catch the final installment of Hidden Kitchens Monday night at 6. This is Central Time on Wisconsin Public Radio.